WTUL New Orleans. I'm here in the station with Tom Zolot from CRA, Center for Restorative Approaches, and we're going to do a little bit of an interview today. All right, Tom, thanks so much for coming in today. I'm so excited.
Of course. Good morning.
Yeah. So, Tom, you're the program coordinator for Center for Restorative Approaches.
Every day.
Do you want to talk for a moment about what Center for Restorative Approaches is?
Yeah. So, we work with workplaces, schools, and other communities, offering kind of training, consulting, and facilitation of dialogue circles, which build communication, attempt to reduce violence, and build the relationships of any given community, and attempt to include those most affected by harm and wrongdoing and help them achieve justice and well-being in those situations.
Okay, so broader than that, to start out, restorative justice.
Yeah, buzzword.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so restorative justice is really a international movement that the U.S. Is learning from a lot of its international partners on how to do really well. It's really been areas of the world where community of colors want to have their local practices mandated for their juveniles mostly, but it's been applied much more broadly than that now. But it started out as trying to kind of bring alternatives to juveniles for communities whose juveniles were getting punished at a much harsher rate than the white communities in those given regions of the world. So
what is its place in this city right now?
In New Orleans? Mm-hmm. Our work has been going on since about 2008 and focuses much more broadly than juveniles in a criminal context. When people use restorative justice, they usually mean criminal alternative to court, diversion, post-prison reentry work. But we do a lot of work in schools, trying to keep kids in schools and out of the criminal justice system from the very beginning. So trying to provide alternatives to kind of school measures, the policies and practices that push kids out of school and into the criminal system, which is usually called the school-to-prison pipeline. So we're trying to block that and bring alternatives that allow kids to stay in school as opposed to being pushed out.
And what do those alternatives look like?
They really look like a couple things. The major thing is training. Training for teachers in alternative tools. Not everything they're taught works for every kid. And the teachers really appreciate new ways to handle kind of tough situations or tough conversations. But also training for administrators in how to set up systems at schools or communities. And it also looks like working with the kids. So when young people get into some sort of conflict, you know, set a bathroom on fire, get caught with a little pot on campus, things that would normally get them in quite a bit of trouble, providing an alternative way that they can repair the harm. And the two pillars of that is relationships and accountability. So you want to bring the people the young person are connected to and responsible to, and then see what the young person can do to make that right. You know, the young person is not off the hook in a lot of ways. They end up having to do more than just getting to sit at home. They end up having to repair it in some way and do a lot of reparative work with their fellow community members.
So in that repairing process, mm-hmm. how do you get those kids to take ownership for what they do? What does that look like?
Well, the first most important thing is not starting with blame. So kids are often, you know, we always ask our kids, why'd you do that? And they always answer the same way. I don't know. And that's a little dance that I always find really interesting, because even young children know that dance. Why did you do that? I don't know. Right. And it's when we start with what happened instead of why. What happened? How did that impact you? How did that impact others? What can we do to make things right? There's no blame in that, right? There is just something that is wrong, and this is an opportunity for us to make it right. But we talk about that tough love, that working with people, that I'm not letting you go until you fix this kind of love, that grandma love. Kids respond really well to that when they're said, when they get to own up, and they get to say, I have the opportunity to fix this. A lot of kids are used to running from punishment. They're used to, they see it coming, they see blame coming, they're ready to dodge it, they're very skilled at that. But when you say, you know, the school is trying to give you an opportunity, and this is your opportunity, can you tell me what happened? A lot of kids respond very well to that.
And you do that through circles, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what a circle is?
Totally. So a restorative circle is that alternative to suspension or expulsion. It can also exist preventatively if young people are yelling in the hallway or something and the school knows something's going to happen. So either way, the school refers to CRA. And then one of our trained facilitators goes out and speaks with everyone involved and affected, which can take an hour or it can take 5 days, depending on the breadth of the situation. And then they sit everyone who needs to be involved down together, everyone who's impacted, and they talk about three things: what happened, who's been affected, and how they want to move forward. And then they come out with an agreement. And then that agreement stands in lieu of disciplinary action. So if they're able to keep the agreement, if we call it compliant with the agreement, then they don't receive the traditional punishment that's kind of hanging over their head. And so that can, you know, we can sit down. I've sat down 2 6-year-olds who were like fussing on the bus, and I've sat down grown adults who have gotten into major incidents. And no young people were even in the room, right? Just the adults got into the... So I've done the gambit both in schools and in workplaces of really, really intense conflicts and really simple, what people would call like kid stuff.
And it works with the kids as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's easier with the kids. The adults, they hold grudges, man. They dig in heels much easier. Kids, you could be my worst enemy one day and you're going to be my best friend the next. I mean, kids are super plastic. They change. But adults are a little harder. They take a little bit more love. You gotta wrestle with them a little bit more. So.
And so how does a whole school culture change look like if you're trying to implement this alternative discipline policy? What does it take within a school to work on that?
Yeah, it takes a couple main pieces. So we started this work doing just those circles in a model that's called community conferencing. And we were doing them and they were going really well, but we found without a larger context, the good effects of 1 hour with some kids are lost when the larger environment isn't touched. And this is a theory that PBIS has, you know, supported for many years, and a lot of folks are coming around to that. It's a whole environment. It's a holistic approach. No behavior exists in a vacuum. And so when you're going to change the culture of a school, along with any given culture change, it actually usually takes like 3 to 5 years in any workplace or home or whatever. It takes quite a while to change the whole culture, which is a set of habits, right, that we all share. And so you need a couple parts. One, in terms of restorative practices, which is all about building, strengthening, and repairing relationships, it's all about finding those times to build relationships, right? You don't just come in and dig right into the content, but you take a little intentional time where you're getting to know each other. And that buys you a lot later. You know, I ask teachers a lot, what does it buy you to build relationships with your kids? They all answer the same way: respect later, trust, they have my ear, you know, they'll tell me. Because that's what teachers really want, is to be told, right? And so, you know, you have to take that intentional time to build relationships. You have to offer skills to the whole community and how to communicate well. You know, my colleague Alan always says, you know, if they don't know math, we teach them. If they don't know reading, we teach them. But if they don't behave well, we punish them, right? So taking the time to give those skills and teaching them. And then it's about providing alternatives. Anything from the small conflicts that the teachers encounter every day, adding them to classroom management skills that they should already have a lot of classroom management skills, but adding a little de-escalation skills and conflict management skills. And then training the administrators. How do you handle major incidents? And, you know, what are the alternatives? And so it's everything from building relationships to giving skills to the kids, the teachers, the administrators. And then it's about looping in parents and about looping in the community as much as possible.
That's awesome. That's really interesting.
Yep.
And then, so you do community building,
yeah,
as well as repairing relationships.
Right, right.
So how do you put in different efforts into those different sections of, I guess, what is essentially a triangle?
Yeah, yeah. So building, strengthening, and repairing relationships, really, the more you work at building relationships, the less work you have to do strengthening or repairing them. And the everyone should get touched by the building relationship work and the skill sharing work. And then less and less people will need the more intensive care or support or alternatives. And that's true in any tiered model. You know, RSD punishment systems use that, discipline systems, the PBIS model uses that, you know, social service support uses that. And then we use the similar kind of 3-tiered model. And I think the way you put effort into building relationships is you decentralize who's in charge of that, right? So I can't go into I not only can't, but it wouldn't behoove the classroom for me to be going into every classroom in New Orleans and building relationships. I want to offer whatever skills or tools the teachers need to do that work, because that's also the person the kids should be building relationships with. They shouldn't be building relationships with me. They're never going to see me again. So when we do the kind of tier three alternatives, I remain neutral. I attempt to bring in whoever needs to be in that room to support that young person. And so I'm keeping those building relationships, strengthening relationships in mind, but I'm really trying to get the young person tied back to their community and not getting any wisdom from me so much as they're getting it from their own mentors and teachers that already exist and already are there in those places.
So as a facilitator, you remain very neutral in the process.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And so we train, you know, those folks to do that work in those places and decentralize who has those skills, and then, you know, give it to them for them to utilize as they see fit. And then only in the most intense situations does a neutral third party really help, right? People talk about mediation, they talk about arbitration, and, you know, folks use these words not really knowing the subtle distinctions between them. But when I facilitate a circle, I am a guest in that home, just being a third party ear that doesn't, in our WeWork, we don't do any arbitration, so we don't decide truth in any way. We just listen, and, you know, a lot of studies show how a third independent person just changes the way people talk to each other, right? Sometimes that's all you need. It's a little pulling back, a little bit of a break to slow down, and the third person being there helps resolve, you know, themselves.
And on a personal level, how do you see yourself as a facilitator in that? You have to remain very neutral, and how does that weigh on you as a human?
Oh, man. Some days it is really, I'm just like the worst person ever, and like I'm the reason everything fell apart, and that's never true either, right? But sometimes it's really hard, and sometimes it's really like glorious, you know? There's a Zora Neale Hurston poem about like standing on the hilltop, like waving God's sword, and then also being in like Hell's Kitchen and like, you know, licking all the pots clean. So as with probably every person, like everyone has those ups and downs. But it's really empowering to watch people handle things themselves once they have just the littlest bit of help, and having a system that allows them to do that for each other. And then sometimes it feels overwhelming because it took so many hours to fix this situation. And I think about how many situations there are on any given block in New Orleans, much less the whole city, much less the whole country. And it just feels a little overwhelming. But every day I feel like I'm doing solid work. So that gets me out of bed.
And you're training a team of people all the time, right?
Oh, man, I could get hit by a bus and this work would keep going, which is when you know you're doing something right, is you could totally fly to Maui and you know, flip the desk and be out of there. And like you've given people enough things that you're just a conduit, you know, and the more I stay with this work, the more conduit will happen. But really, there's really amazing people who are a lot better than me too already in the city doing really cool work.
And I want to go back for a second to the place of ownership for people who are restoring relationships and repairing harm. What does that look like for them? How do you conclude a case?
Yeah, so there are three stages to our work. We do prep work, where we talk to each person individually, and then we have the circle itself, which usually takes about an hour, and then we do follow-up, which can be anywhere from 2 weeks to longer. So that's in the circle. If we've agreed that you're going to help the cafeteria clean up the room or something for a week, I'll come back a week later and say, you know, were we able to complete that, and did it meet the spirit of the agreement that we decided? So in the agreement, we'll decide when someone should come back in and check in on that, which when we train folks, we always ask teachers, what does that buy you to do follow-up with kids? And teachers always say, well, they know I actually was watching, right? There's a bit of an accountability thing, and they know that I mean what I'm saying, right? And so we're instilling those things in the young people or adults who are in these circles, which is that this was not a one-and-done situation. This was about fully reparation of harm and the spirit of reparation, and we're gonna be following up, and if it's not met, we can do this again. We can keep at this process. So a lot of follow-up work that's decided by the participants, and then once that's complete, it's called compliant, and then we pass it back to the school and say all the parties have been compliant with the agreement, da 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 da, and then either days will be removed or it'll, you know, they'll pull it from their record, things like that, and that allows this structural alternative for the school.
And I'm really personally interested in the storytelling aspect of the restorative approaches. Do you want to talk a little bit about what storytelling's role is in that structure?
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's not something we lift up as much, but it's present. We know that when I tell a story, you know, if I tell a story about a young man who was really struggling in class, but then was able to sit down with his teacher. They realized there were some language issues. They were able to get him some glasses. His parent and the teacher connected because they had a translator. They never had that opportunity. Your brain, in listening to that story, just lived some of those experiences, right? We know that the brain releases hormones that relate to the experience that we're describing. So there's this intense connection, right, between hearing someone else's story and being able to relate to them. Right. And so when we're, you know, so much of our stuff happens over social media between our young people. When we're looking at a screen or we're not looking at the person, we're able to have this view of them that is disconnected from the humanity that's actually there. So when we're able to sit people down and they're actually able to say how it impacted them, something happens, right? Something literally happens in their brain that they live that story with them. And then they're able to say, look, I see that this hurt you. I was thinking this when that happened, and I'm willing to do this to make it right, but I need you to do this, right? So they're able to enter into negotiation after the story has happened, right? So we don't jump straight to solutions. That what happened stage, what happened next, how were you feeling at the time, what were you thinking, what do you think they were thinking, what did they do, how did you respond? That whole piece needs to be completed for that humanizing aspect, right? And it unlocks so many doors when they go from their individual stories to a shared story, right? We all agree what the story was now. And I don't dictate what that story is. And that story is usually not what probably happened. But the people involved agree that that's what happened from their various perspectives. And so they're combining all their stories into one shared narrative. And then once that's aligned, then they can move forward, right? And this connects to trauma work because it is the disconnected story that creates trauma because the brain goes back and tries to fix the narrative. And so, you know, you're able to actually pull that person away from that fight or flight moment of the actual fight, and they can move on to repairing the harm and asking for what they need, right? They come out of their fight or flight response into their more calm nervous system response. So it's awesome. The storytelling aspect is huge. And we talk about it a bit. We focus more on like what do teachers need to get through the day, but I think about it a lot.
Right.
So
there's a whole lot going on there. You can't do it all.
Oh yeah.
And I love that little saying that I've heard y'all say, everyone has a little piece of the truth.
That's right.
The collaborative story.
That's right.
And what can people do to get involved or learn more?
Yeah, I mean, the easiest thing to do is our main, like, expressive forum is the website, so thecra.net. We have this great intern who monitors our Facebook and Twitter, and so you can catch us the Center for Restorative Approaches. We're the only Center for Restorative Approaches in New Orleans, so you can find us pretty easily. But you can reach out. There's a contact us on the website. You can email at us, thecra@thecra.net. We take a lot of interns and volunteer facilitators for those inside or outside of Tulane. There's a lot of opportunities to just support our work, come see our work, and see if you can get involved.
And on your own, work on restoring relationships.
That's
and
right.
Building communities.
That's right. You know, we always talk about it being, you can't undo your restorative training. And like, you know, we carry this home with our friends and family, and they yell at us and stop restoring us.
Trying to restore all your friends by asking what happened when they try to vent.
Yeah, they don't even realize. I'm like, tell me what happened. Ah, you know, how did that impact you? Well, I guess this. How do you want to move forward? And then by then they're like, wait a minute, you're working me here. And I was like, I'm just talking. I'm just here.
Yeah, just being a good friend.
That's right.
All right, Tom, thanks so much for joining us. That was super fun.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Yeah.